This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading again segments from Carl Safina's book, Eye of the Albatross, subtitled Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. We've been in Alaska, we've been all over the Pacific Ocean, and we've been on many of the Hawaiian islands and atolls. Today, we're on Midway in a chapter called Midway, and we're going to be learning about tuna research. Last week, we got a portrait of Midway Island. It's a place people can actually visit. He called it Small Town USA, along with 2 million seabirds. And we met Dave Aitano, a tuna researcher. And one more thing, Nancy Barron, who's referred to quite a few times here, is an award-winning nature writer from Canada. I'll read a little bit of last week's to give you a good introduction to this week. In the evening, Nancy and I introduce ourselves to David Aitano, a fish scientist. David's father, a biochemist, put the fishing bug in young Dave during frequent excursions around Chesapeake Bay and Maine. Dave would say, "When I grow up, I want a job where they pay me to go fishing." Dave's current job is research into the populations and movements of tunas in the Pacific. He studies their travels by putting number tags into thousands of fish, releasing them, and seeing where other people recapture them. Dave has offered to take us with him for a day of tagging yellowfin and big-eye tuna at a sunken seamount 40 miles from Midway. Even at face value, this prospect would rate as sensational. Even more exciting is that these waters have been off limits to fishing boats for about 50 years because of the former military base. The place we're going remains as close to untouched as any place in the open ocean can claim to be. As Robert Frost exclaimed, "May something always go unharvested. May much stay out of our stated plan." And I'll overlap a little bit more with last week. Nancy and I walked toward the boat in post-midnight darkness. In the open areas around us, occasional Bonin petrel chicks are fledging straight from their burrows. These young birds have never seen daylight, never yet flown. A young Bonin petrel must, in one step, come out into the real world, find the sea, and begin its life-or-death odyssey of living, traveling, and finding food in the ocean, all on its own, all at once. The boat is a cabin cruiser usually used for Midway sport fishing charters. The captain is David Wolf. Rounding out the crew is mate Mike Meredith. Mike has been here only 2 weeks and loves it. For me, it's the opportunity of a lifetime. And now more about Dave Aitano. When Dave was 16, he and his brother fished commercially off La Jolla, California, from a tiny car-top portable boat. We located a hole right near shore that was loaded with big, beautiful vermilion rockfish. We made 20-hook rigs and pulled up full lines every time. We got about 8 cents a pound, but that lasted less than a year. We fished it out. It was my first experience of fishing out a part of the ocean. Whenever I go back to visit my family, I take that little boat and row it through the surf and fire up the clicker and line up the sights and get back to that spot and fish it. And to this day, 30 years later, it has never recovered. There were other spots that got fished out too. So that was a lesson. In college, I stayed out a whole semester just to catch Dungeness crabs off Northern California. Then the price plummeted to nothing. So that was another lesson. Booms bust. Third lesson. There's a place along the La Jolla shore that was made a protected park in the early 70s. It didn't take very long for the place to start recovering. Soon, you could find lots of small lobsters and green abalones in the caves and in the crevices. So that was another interesting lesson. Leave it alone before you fish it out, and it'll recover. When Dave was still in college, salmon were still a big part of the West Coast scene. There were hundreds of mom-and-pop salmon boats. It was a very clean fishery, all hook and line, very selective, very high quality, especially the big king salmon, all banquet fish. Then in August, we'd go far offshore chasing albacore. You could roam the whole California, Oregon, Washington coast. I love that fishery. So, he continues, when I returned from college, boy, it was such a shock to learn that the salmon had collapsed and so many of those beautiful rivers I used to know were in such desperate trouble. After college, Dave saw the ocean from one of the first really big boats to explore for tuna in the western Pacific. Quote, it was a 220-foot, 1,200-ton super seiner with a helicopter and everything. Compared to the 40-foot salmon troller I was accustomed to, the seiner was a huge ship, unquote. The fishing gear was a purse seine, an enormous curtain of netting dropped around a school of fish in a circle, and then pursed together at the bottom. They fished waters off Samoa, New Zealand, New Guinea, Micronesia, and elsewhere. Quote, we had amazing fishing power. Some of those schools were incredibly huge back then. We followed one school of skipjack tuna that was too big to get a net around, and finally it split in half. And then the half that we were following split in thirds. We wrapped the net around one of those thirds, in other words, 1/6, the original school, and bagged 280 tons in one set. Most of these guys would set the net regardless of whether there was enough room left in the hold for all the fish. So we would kill, say, 90 tons of skipjack in one set of the net for the sake of filling up the remaining 30 tons of room on board at the end of a voyage. The rest we dumped. Dave sums up, so all my life I've fished and then seen myself as part of a big problem. Dave figured aquaculture, seafood farming, might be the answer. Quote, but soon after I entered the field, I saw that it mostly raises delicacies for high-end markets. It's not an answer to hunger. So after all these experiences, I think well-managed wild fisheries are generally the way to go. Dave stayed with the tuna boat for 3 years, married an American schoolteacher he met in Samoa, worked 5 years as a Samoan government fisheries biologist, and fathered 2 daughters. Quote, I was perfectly happy there. Nice people. It's an easy place to raise kids. If your kid disappears, it's because some big Samoan lady is giving her treats that you don't want her to have. Unquote. But then Dave got offered a job in a large-scale tuna tagging project based in New Caledonia. The project put serially numbered tags on a couple of 100,000 tunas in waters of 23 island nations and territories over an immense area of the Pacific. Quote, the tagging project showed that the tuna resources were vast, much larger than previously thought. That was before modern purse seine fishing really got established in that region. Dave then moved to the University of Hawaii to undertake an ambitious study of tuna reproduction and travels. By dissecting over 10,000 yellowfin tuna, he learned that they spawn up to 11 million eggs at a time, and they do this every other day for weeks at a stretch. Despite virtually limitless trillions of eggs, the ocean is not overflowing with yellowfin tuna because the chances of a baby tuna surviving to adulthood are vanishingly small. In his current project's first year, Dave has tagged nearly 12,000 yellowfin and big-eye tuna. So far, he has found that individual big-eye tuna remain at seamounts longer than yellowfins. Roughly 9% of his tagged tuna have already gotten recaptured in the first 12 months, both in Hawaiian waters and at points north and westward, indicating surprising fishing pressure, even in so seemingly vast an ocean. This tagging project is what Nancy and I will participate in the morning. At first light, we're in a different world, all water and one circular horizon. A few sooty terns were calling in the darkness when we arrive, and now we can see them flying here and there, and we can see a few lazen and black-footed albatrosses working over the ocean's surface. It remains fully impressive that the birds can find and relocate this precise spot within that great circle. A jetliner's vapor trail provides the only proof of humanity's continuing existence somewhere. Our deck is crowded with coolers, fishing gear, and a big blue plastic barrel. Soon after we left the harbor, we discovered a stowaway Bonin petrel on the back deck hiding behind some of that gear. It was in a spot we couldn't reach and has now disappeared from view. A prepping table is loaded with fishing lures. The lures don't look too much like fish, but they're made to move like fish when pulled through the water. Nancy is impressed with their garishness. Their chrome heads and brightly colored plastic skirts. She says, some of those lures look positively lurid. The quarter moon notwithstanding, we have arrived at our own sea of tranquility. We're over the Ladd Seamount, a submerged mountain that comes up as close to the surface as 37 fathoms, 222 feet, out of water 2,500 fathoms deep. That's 21,000 feet. A few tens of millions of years ago, we would have called it Hawaii and sold t-shirts and surfboards, and it would have been about 1,000 miles east of here. Now it has a higher purpose. In the east, the clouds are turning gold and pink. The clear sky overhead seems devoid of moisture, but low clouds rim the horizon. Aitano checks the instruments and announces what the albatrosses and other birds have already told us. We're right on the spot. The air is moving at under 10 knots, not quite breeze enough to sail an albatross. They're trying to use the cushion of air between themselves and the water, but they're also doing a fair amount of flapping. I wonder what they've been eating here. I'm surprised to see so many ferry terns this far from land. A couple of wedge-tailed shearwaters also are weaving along the ocean surface. At the moment, we can see a few dozen birds scattered around. David says, keep an eye out for some birds to start forming flocks. They should start hunting soon. Dave has readied two heavy fishing rods with big reels, plus two heavy hand lines. All the line is very strong, 400-pound test. To help get fish in quickly on the back of the boat, he's rigged a hydraulic hauler of the kind usually used to pull up strings of lobster traps. He says when he first came to this seamount, they weren't able to reel the big fish in fast enough to prevent numerous shark attacks, hence the heavy lines and the hydraulic hauler. That sounds like a lot of sharks. Nearly everywhere in the world you travel, the main story you hear about sharks is how many there aren't nowadays compared to times past. This place apparently is different. The rising sun is poised just below the horizon, about to burn its way through a cloud. Time to go tuna fishing, announces Dave. He, Mike, and I stream the lures astern. We stop them about 50 to 75 feet behind the moving boat, and they pop to the surface, skipping and darting like fleeing prey fish. Dave sets the reel's drag brakes at 50 pounds. Not an inch of line will budge from the spool until whatever is at the other end exerts at least 50 pounds of pulling power. The two outside lines are run from the tips of the fishing rods to poles called outriggers that hold the lines out away from the boat, helping to prevent tangles. A clothespin-like clip holds the fishing line to the outriggers, and you run the clip up to the end of the outriggers like running a flag up a pole. The two inside hand lines go straight to their lures. So now we're trolling, dragging four lures, watching them skipping in our wake. We're pulling the lures pretty quickly, about 10 miles an hour, but we're after fish that can sprint five times that speed. They're the fastest fish in the known universe. One tern starts hovering excitedly nearby, and a tuna crashes twice through the surface. Immediately, more birds wing speedily toward the spot, streaming in from all directions. Right away, you can tell this is an aerobic place to make a living. This is the big league. 4 billion years of product testing and refinement have produced animals at the top of their game. The fastest swimmers, the most exquisite flyers, and we'd like to thank the best fishers. A pile of sooty terns gathers to our right and starts diving. Dave shouts to Captain Wolf up on the bridge and points to the commotion. Wolf turns the boat toward the birds. I glance back at our churning wake and the skittering lures. Nancy suddenly points out, "Oh my God, look at all the fish jumping there!" I look forward and see silhouetted fish exploding from the water and sailing through the air like tossed footballs. There's nothing floppy about them. They're projectiles, missiles, bombs. The starboard lure gets bit, but the fish comes off immediately after popping the line from the outrigger clip. Half a minute later, the port outrigger snaps, and the line shoots tight and begins peeling off the reel. But that fish quickly comes off, too. The leaping fish vanish. The birds disperse. A few minutes later, a nice fish yanks a hand line taut and stays on. Aitano grabs the line and slips it into the hauler winch. Soon the fish appears beneath our turbulent wake, a life of shining silver, gleaming white, glowing yellow. Dave opens a door in the transom, grabs the line, and slides the fish through onto a pad on deck. It's a yellowfin tuna, ahi in Hawaiian, gorgeous and bright, a laminated, decorated speed package. Nancy flashes me a smile. Like nearly everyone on the planet, she's never seen a living tuna. Its great beauty impresses her. She's admiring the dark ocean blue back, how it blends downward first to electric blue, then into the bronzy burnishing along the side, to the pearly belly, the silver hard gill plates, the large eyes bearing light blue irises, the lightened vertical flank markings creating stripes and spots, the shape of the fusiform body from nose to the rigid keels along its stiff crescent-shaped tail, the wing-like pectoral fins and the bright yellow emarginations of the fins, and the rows of little yellow finlets running along the tailward third of both the back and the belly, which the fish controls like rudders, the way its larger fins vanish into slots to eliminate friction during streaking bursts of speed. Dave pops a tag into the fish's back, a nylon dart with a number on it. It sticks out like a little streamer. Each tag says, "Hawaii Tagging Project," and then the serial number. Dave slides the fish out the door into a tape recorder hung in a waterproof bag around his neck. He dictates, "Tag number 89, yellowfin, 80 centimeters. He's still saying centimeters when another fish hits one of the hand lines and is hooked. Dave slides that fish through the door, disengages the hook, and throws the lure back in so that the line is already fishing again before he even has the tag in the tuna's back. These fish are small so far, only about 15 pounds. They're easily manageable. Each fish is on deck for 15 seconds or less. Aitano can handle more action, so he asks Mike to add another hand line. Now we're trolling 5 lines. I hear an outrigger clip go snap, and the reel near my head starts screaming. This is a really hot fish. I mean, the reel is shrieking. Even against the drag brake set at 50 pounds of pressure, this thing is burning line off the spool. Dave reaches for the whizzing line and it cuts his glove open. This fish takes out all the 400-pound test line intended to be all the line needed for almost any fish out there, and now we're into the 130-pound test backing. A much smaller fish hits a hand line, a 15-pounder, and Dave tags it. Now I'm charged with keeping the line on the rod tight, which the hot fish does by itself. Dave grabs my line in his damaged glove, slips it into the hauler, and in a few minutes we have a yellowfin weighing 60 pounds coming through the door. This one was incredibly strong for its moderate size. We were expecting a much bigger fish. I'd like to see a 200-pounder pull. We've been fishing for 15 minutes and we've tagged 4 tuna. Not bad. Our stowaway Bond and Petrel makes a sudden appearance from under the bait prepping table, then goes back into hiding. 2 more fish rise to the lures, sink their hard teeth into the soft plastic, and feel a steely sting. 1 small big-eye tuna, 1 small yellowfin. The big-eye weighs about 25 pounds. It's got slight barring on the belly in the rear half, a bigger, stouter head, and a deeper body that got it the Latin name obesus. This is a baby. They can grow to be several hundred pounds if they live long enough. Captain Wolf turns the boat toward another group of about 100 diving birds over breaking fish. Immediately, two more fish rise and strike. This time, all the lines tangle. Fish are now spurting and darting through the surface, practically alongside us. Under a fluttering, diving flock of excited noddies and sooty terns, a couple of wedgies and fairy terns, and one lays an albatross. Except for the albatross, these birds depend almost completely on tuna to drive prey to the surface where they can get at it. Overfishing threatens even them, because no tuna, or very few, would mean all these birds starve. About a dozen and a half sooties swoop in and check themselves over our splashing lures. I'm watching the lures skipping, and I see a big splash behind one. A few seconds later, a tuna sucks the lure under, snaps the line from the outrigger clip, and then streaks away. Again, all of the heaviest line goes, and the fish takes it far into the backing. This fish requires attention. We clear all the other lines out of the water and start backing down on it. I put the reel into low gear, Captain Wolf yells from the bridge. Come on, Carl, crank, reel, reel. I begin putting line back on the reel as the boat backs down farther. Dave gets the line into the hauler, but still the fish is pulling very, very hard, even with the hydraulic hauler. The fish is coming only slowly. Dave suddenly calls, shark! A yellowish Galapagos shark that I estimate at perhaps 200 pounds, and Dave thinks weighs 250, grabs the tuna, engulfing it so thoroughly that it itself gets hooked. The shark corkscrews downward and the rod swivels violently to meet the arcing movement as it powers away. We work it to the surface. Another very hefty shark appears. We have a shark coming to eat a shark, says Mike. I'm not sure he's right about the second shark's intentions, but I'm not sure he's wrong. The first shark suddenly pulls so hard that it breaks open the snap connecting the leader and gets free. A minute and a half later, we get blasted by another double header of tuna. The first of them gets seriously raked by a shark. Dave decides not to tag it and calls it a keeper. It's 100+ pounds, and Dave says it's about 4 years old. Nancy says, how magical that it would grow so big so fast. She adds, seeing it come from the ocean strikes me mostly as tragedy. A sizable school of tuna comes up about 50 yards to our right, our port side. Wolf turns the boat sharply to meet them. The fish that we're keeping is still on the deck, rapidly drumming its stiff tail. Nancy says, look at its rainbow of colors changing as it dies. It gasps and throws up a flying fish and a squid. I'm thinking, I'm glad these fish can't scream. Dave comes with a sharp pick and delivers a pithing stab to its brain. The fish shudders and then goes silvery still. Nancy murmurs to me, now that it's dead, it looks like a beautiful work of art. Wolf says, looks like they're smiling when they die. Nancy turns to him, saying, lucky for us. The cockpit is a mess of blood, lines, and lures. We need to get organized. The shark's abrasive skin did a lot of damage to the line it hit. So Dave cuts off the last few yards and reties the leader. This gives me a moment to ice the damaged tuna, hose the deck, and look around and reorient to the bird's activities. The water is deep, clear indigo. The light breezes manage to put white caps on the ocean, but there's no swell to speak of. There is some big stuff swimming around here. I peel down to a t-shirt before we're ready to troll again. I started to really sweat on the last one. When the sun gets up, it's strong. Nancy looks around and says, man, it's hot for 7 o'clock. A large wahoo latches on, a cousin of tunas. The wahoo may be the fastest fish in the ocean, and this one rips out a line in a way that leaves that reputation vividly reinforced. Alongside, 5 feet long and about 60 pounds, it shows a silvery belly and dark back, and its flanks are tiger-marked with broad, wavy, dark green bars, alternating against aquamarine. Very striking. This fish is a painted javelin. Its entire body seems an instrument of speed and impact. It appears more barracuda-like than a barracuda, a hypercuda. It's got lots of teeth, very little patience, and is scary enough that Nancy leaps dancer-like across the cockpit to distance herself even before it comes aboard. Wolf calls from the bridge, "Nice Ono," using its Hawaiian name, Nancy registering her new fear of Wahoo with an anglicized name begins referring to them as "Oh no." Nancy's never seen a fish like this before and she's awed. "They frighten me," she says with a nervous laugh. She says these creatures all seem like implements of war. The Wahoo like spears, the tunas like torpedoes, the sharks like heat-seeking missiles. This version of the Battle of Midway has been happening every day for a long, long time, and all these creatures live inside the sea's most sophisticated weaponry. Dave grunts, "Hefty one," as he leads the Wahoo through the stern door and onto the deck. Meanwhile, a Galapagos shark that Wolf says might be the biggest he's ever seen comes and eats a tuna that Mike had just brought alongside. I estimate it's weighted over 300 pounds. Wolf estimates 400. He's a professional fisherman, so he's probably exaggerating. Anyway, it's big, and now it's hooked. It takes us about 15 minutes to subdue this shark and work it to the boat. This animal is bulky. Dave reaches over with a knife and makes a slight slice in its lip to free the hook. Nancy says seeing Dave trying to get the hook out of this huge, tawny shark reminds her of David against Goliath. Upon release, the shark turns a parting shot and whacks the boat with its tail. Dave looks at us with wide eyes, saying, "Phew!" When the next tuna feeds another shark, I start feeling bad about it. Not that I have anything against sharks, obviously, but you want them to catch their own fish for their own moral, psychological, and spiritual well-being, and ours. We decide to go looking elsewhere on the seamount. Of the hundreds of tuna I've caught or witnessed in three oceans before today, I can remember only two getting bitten by a shark while on the line. While big sharks have gotten rare in most places, here they remain so abundant we have to get away from them. I like that part. I'll stop there. I've been reading segments from the book Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, Visions of Hope and Survival, reading from the chapter titled Midway. I hope you're enjoying it, learning all about the Pacific and about fisheries and birds, all kinds of things we don't experience every day. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.